Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the last week of June. I'm your host, Nan Evans. My guest today is Lee Calvet. She's the author of a new book titled The Hidden Lives of Owls, The Science and Spirit of Nature's Most Elusive Birds. I talked with Lee on Nature Now during the first week of June, and you can listen to this program on KPTZ's podcasts at kptz.org. Lee Calvet's new book was actually number 9 on the recent New York Times bestseller list of animal books. I found the book to be a very nice read, science mixed with a naturalist's interpretations and emotions. Plus, it is sensitively illustrated and is beautiful, with drawings of different owl species by the renowned artist Tony Angel. But before we listen to my conversation with Lee, let's hear our mystery sound of the week. Just a quick bit of a hint, that is not an owl, but the call of a bird that I watched during a recent walk in Port Townsend on the trails behind the Blue Heron Middle School. So, observations around town. The weather's in the news. Last week was the summer solstice, and nationally, heat waves are in the news. Planes are being grounded in places like Phoenix. California has seen some of the highest temperatures ever recorded. And a recent scientific study found that 30% of the world's population is currently exposed to potentially deadly heat for 20 days per year or more. Yet, here in our Salish Sea ecosystem, we have been having delightful weather, even if it has been cloudy and cool at times. Well, my curiosity about high temperature days led me to Cliff Mass's blog. Cliff Mass is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington and a preeminent authority on the weather of the Pacific Northwest. Googling Cliff Mass will lead you directly to his blog. I had some fairly simple questions. When do the hottest day of the year occur in various places around the U.S.? Well, Cliff's blog had a fascinating map showing the average day of the warmest temperatures at places around the U.S. There are amazing differences, with some places having their warmest temperatures in June, such as southern Arizona and New Mexico, while others having their typical highest temperatures in September, like coastal California. That's a 3-month range. So the next simplistic question is, why do different locations have such radically different dates for their highest temperature day? And why isn't the hottest day of the year the day when the sun is strongest, the day that is the longest, and it's most overhead? That, of course, is the summer solstice around June 21st. And, relatedly, why isn't the hottest time of a day at noon when the sun is directly overhead? The short answer is that the hottest time of day is when there is the amount of solar radiation coming into the Earth exceeding what's going out as infrared radiation to space. However, there is a thermal inertia. The atmosphere and the surface delays warming. For instance, things like soils and water and air take some time to warm up. That, of course, is way too simplistic and explanation for the vast differences between different areas. The warmest day across the nation, as I mentioned, varies from, say, the summer solstice to around the solar equinox in September. And then there's that crazy situation along the thin coastal strip where we live that results in many locations that don't hit their high temperatures until late August or September. Well, let me recommend a good read of Cliff Mass's blog to understand the various factors that can affect the timing of the hottest day in different regions of the country. Well, now let's go on to my conversation with Lee Calvet, author of the book, The Hidden Lives of Owls, The Science and Spirit of Owls. Lee was in town a while back doing a reading at the Writer's Workshop and Imprint Bookstore. Lee was gracious enough to let me interview her before her evening reading. The first part of this interview aired the first week of June and is available as a podcast from kptz.org. Let's now hear that second part of our conversation about owls and Lee Calvet's book.
I now have a really odd question. Do you think owls are wise?
When I started writing this book, I was coming at it from a scientific perspective because I didn't know about owls. They have a very small brain because their eyes and the rest of their nerve endings take up so much room in their skull. So their brain is very small. So I didn't think they would be very intelligent. But after being with owls out in the wilderness and watching their behavior and studying them and just being in their energy, their presence, I believe they are wise. I believe they have a lot to tell us and teach us.
Sort of gives me little chills. Makes me want to go watch owls, too. Which may lead to my next question. What are the best ways to observe owls?
The way I did it, because I didn't know much about owls, was I found people that did. I found scientists that were studying them. And so I went out and watched what they were doing. And also learned of the Audubon Society's owling trips. Local groups offer different owling, because there's different owls in different areas. In Washington State, we have the Washington Ornithological Society, and they too offer owling trips now and again.
Interesting. So go out with someone who knows
a birder.
How to look. Yeah.
If you don't know about owls, a birder, a friend or someone you know, is a really great way to get out there.
Do you have a favorite owl?
That's like asking, do I have a favorite child?
Child? That's right. Unfair question.
I certainly have spent the most time with burrowing owls over on the Umatilla Chemical Depot. I continue to return to that project with David Johnson. And then the great gray owl that I helped to save that family when the father was killed certainly has a place in my heart.
Talk to me a moment about burrowing owls, because we often think of owls in trees, but burrowing, do they build the burrow themselves, or do they find cavities that have been made by something else?
Yeah, and that I think that's a big part of why they're in trouble at this point, because they don't build their own burrows. And in eastern Oregon and Washington, it's the badger that builds the burrows that they use.
Oh, interesting.
And badgers are in trouble, and so burrowing owls are in trouble. Badgers are not looked on kindly in most areas.
Yeah. I'm sure there must be areas where the badger population is way down. Can the burrowing owls find substitutes?
Well, and David Johnson, who on the Umatilla Chemical Depot, has started putting in artificial burrows for the owls.
Oh.
It's a big, like a half of a 50-gallon barrel, like a wine barrel. He doesn't use wine barrels, but they're big plastic barrels. He buries them, and that's the chamber for the owls, and then it attaches a 10-foot long, like one of those big black drainage pipes with a 6 to 4 inch diameter.
And so that makes a really big burrow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's about 10-foot long tunnel back to this burrow, and then we have a bucket that we put on top that we can look down into there and keep track of the owl.
Interesting.
How many babies they're having, catch them and weigh them every year, the adults, and tag the babies then.
So how are owls doing in the modern world in terms of conservation status?
Some owls are just fine, and then other owls are really having a hard time. Burrowing owls, because they are in areas where people want to develop, there's a lot more development, they get paved over. And down in Florida, there's a population down there that is having the same trouble, just plain development. And then the spotted owl.
The story we know.
We know that.
Yeah.
And the loss of the forest and that kind of thing. And now the barred owls coming in.
As a competitor.
Competing for.
So which of the owls are doing really well?
Great horned owls are doing really well. Barred owls are doing really well. Because they'll eat just about anything. They're very cosmopolitan, we say, in their eating. whereas spotted owls eat just a few things. So
they're having more trouble. As usual,
yeah.
The more adaptable
yes, absolutely.
A creature is, yeah. the better they'll do.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking just a little bit before we started the interview that there are really two groups of owls. Can you just kind of briefly describe those two groups?
There's the barn owls, Titanidae, and they are the oldest owls. I think there's 50-some species of them mm-hmm. in the world. There's only one species in the United States.
And I think of that as sort of a heart-shaped
face,
and it's a very dramatic
yes.
face.
Yeah. Yes. And then the true owls, or the Strigidae, are all the other owl species.
Title of your book is The Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
There seem to be owl stuff, an owl as symbols. My husband adopted the owl as his, he had a little private consulting business.
And, oh, yeah.
And he's got a Northwest Native drawing of an owl that uh-huh. he used uh-huh. as his symbol. Tell me a bit about sort of the proliferation of things owlish. Any speculation you might have about why that's the case?
It is the thing that got me to write this book. Because I sort of live my life through synchronicities.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, actually, I was in a cafe and there was a barred owl photo exhibit.
Mm.
And I was walking by and I saw this photograph and these dark black eyes were just staring at me. And I stopped what I was doing and I just sort of stood there and looked at that owl. It was like it was looking into me.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know how you get that sort of
yeah,
feeling up
yeah.
your back. It's like, whoa. And then I started seeing owls everywhere. They were on mugs. They were on journals. They were on hand towels. They were everywhere. Owls were everywhere. And I took that to mean they're trying to tell us something.
Mm-hmm.
What are they trying to tell us? And that's sort of what I explored in this book. It's a little bit about my story and how I relate to nature and how the owl sort of got me back to myself.
Wow. So the universe was speaking to you.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. So I think perhaps that will lead us to the end of this interview and say, I need to read this book. Tell me the title of it again and where can people find it?
The Hidden Lives of Owls, The Science and Spirit of Nature's Most Elusive Birds. Any local bookstore can order it if they don't have it. It is also available online at the normal places.
Oh, and I did see when I went online to find out a little bit more about the book that, I can't remember exactly, like you're number 6 on the New York Times bestsellers for animal books?
It was number 9.
Number 9.
Yes.
I said the wrong number. Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a New York Times bestseller. It was very exciting.
Wow, that is very exciting. Well, then I think I need to get the whole book. So, thanks again, Lee. This has been really interesting, and thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Well, my conversation with Lee Calvet certainly helped me think about owls in different ways, and I hope listeners are intrigued to learn more about these fascinating birds in our midst. To conclude the subject of owls, I wanted to do a brief reading from Lee's book. And these are Lee Calvet's Notes from the Field, Insights from an Owl. And Nature Now sound engineer Charlie Fleischman will help me share these insights with you. The first one, keep only what is useful. Regurgitate the rest.
Be patient. Eventually, something will move.
Learn through play.
Only 1 out of 4 or 5 tries yields a mouse. Never give up.
Accept help when it is offered.
Adapt to stay resilient.
Travel every 4 to 6 months.
Take time to sit and observe.
Death is a necessary ingredient in life. Accept the transformation.
Never foul your own nest.
And parenthood is temporary.
The great gray owl does not see what the great horned owl sees. Perspective is everything.
Withhold judgment. Nature does not take sides.
Where you live is not nearly as important as where you are alive.
So that's wisdom from an owl via Lee Calvet. Well, let's now go back to that mystery sound. Let's hear the sound again. Well, the song that we usually hear from this animal is as follows. So that last song was the typical call of a male red-winged blackbird, that sort of characteristic conch-a-li that goes high. It's a classic sound of wetlands across the continent. The mystery sound was a less common call, a distinctive matter-of-fact check, check, that's fairly easy to recognize, except I didn't when I was hearing it. Both males and females make these calls year-round, in flight and while feeding, and when confronting rivals to raise an alarm. My presence near a male red-winged blackbird at the edge of a small wetland behind Blue Heron Middle School triggered this warning to me, and perhaps to others, that I just might be a threat. Red-winged blackbirds are, of course, one of the most abundant birds across North America and one of the most boldly colored. The red-winged blackbird is a familiar sight atop cattails, along soggy roadsides, and on telephone wires. Glossy black males have scarlet and yellow shoulder patches that they can puff up or hide, depending on how they feel. The females are a subdued, streaky brown, almost like a large, dark sparrow. Well, looking ahead, upcoming events. So, with the able help of Charlie Fleischman, what's happening?
With the advent of summer, opportunities to explore and experience the natural world around us abound. Check out the ranger-led hikes, walks, and talks offered by the Olympic National Park at Staircase, Hurricane Ridge, Heart of the Hills, the Ho River, and Calaloc. The summer weather also brings fun opportunities for astronomical observations from Hurricane Ridge. Check the Olympic National Park website for details.
And the Washington chapter of the Sierra Club presents what promises to be an evening of probably inspirational discussions on conservation, bipartisanship, and hope. Bill Bradley, former Democratic U.S. Senator from New Jersey, and I think basketball star, and Dan Evans, former Republican Washington governor and U.S. Senator, will speak on Wednesday, June 28th in Seattle. More information is available at the Washington State Sierra Club website.
For a more local focus, on Thursday, July 6th, join the Native Plant Society for a long summer hike and botanizing to Marmot Pass in the Buckhorn Wilderness. Explore the many floral ranges as you ascend to the 6,100-foot pass. The outing starts from the Quilcene Forest Service Ranger Station.
And lastly, join the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society Book Club for its July read. Linda Lear's recent biography titled Rachel Carson, A Witness for Nature. The book club will meet on July 24th, so start reading now. Google Natural History Society Jefferson Land Trust for more information. Anyone is welcome to join the book club. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. You can contact us at Nature Now, that's one word, naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM. On Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Owls, performed by Leo Kottke.